August 13th for the Liquid Sound Lounge annual Summer Soulful House Music Boat Dance Party. Taking it to the waters with yours truly, DJ Jeannie Hopper on the decks, and guest Kim Lightfoot, as well as Jay Rodriguez live on sax and flute aboard the Cabana, East 23rd Street Marina off the East River in Manhattan. 11 p.m. boarding, departing at midnight, returning at 3 a.m. Proceeds go to support listener-sponsored non-commercial community radio, WBAI. For tickets and further information, go to brownpapertickets.com and search Liquid Sound Lounge. All aboard, August 13th.
Your smartphone, your computer, your television, all of this technology is constantly undergoing change. But whether it's for better or for worse is something we need to decide. Our show, Off the Hook, is a hacker's perspective on new technology. Will the newest phone or flat screen truly be beneficial, or will it be another tool of exploitation? Join Emmanuel Goldstein and his crew on Wednesdays from 7 to 8 p.m. and hear the perspective of the editor and publisher of 2600 Magazine, a source for the latest in tech security flaws. Even if you aren't tech savvy, you deserve to know if that new device will end up helping or hindering your life. Listen to Off the Hook on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. here on WBAI 99.5 FM and online at WBAI.org.
Hi, this is Chloe Glickman, and I'm an intern at WBAI. Looking to get professional experience doing something you're actually passionate about? At WBAI, I'm able to develop skills in journalism, marketing, event planning, editing, social networking, and much more, all while working directly with producers and the management team. BAI is always taking applications for credit and non-credit internships, so get in touch today. Send an email to internships@wbai.org for more information. Join the team that supplied New York with independent radio for over 50 years. Help keep community radio going strong.
Members of two recent delegations to Palestine, a prison labor and academic delegation, and a Dream Defender delegation, will report on what they saw and heard, and how it echoes current repression and current struggles for justice here. Join us on Friday, July 15th, 6:30 p.m. at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Center, 3940 Broadway at 165th Street, for a discussion of how the U.S. and Israel use incarceration to contain and dismantle resistance, and how we can push back and support the boycott movement. For more information, call 347-709-2264 or email bringmumiahome@gmail.com.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. The time is just about, 7 o'clock. That means it's time for Off the Hook.
Understood, but did we know?
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this delightful Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
And Kyle.
Hello, hackers.
And somewhere is Bernie S.
Greetings from Philadelphia. I'm actually in a closet in the back of an Irish pub right now.
Well, we don't need to know about your private life. It's
who put you there?
Yeah, it's not really.
I'll be coming out of the closet in an hour, though.
Uh huh. Okay. Well, good to hear that too. And we'll have a special guest coming on board in just a little bit. But first, some news updates, things that have been going on in the last few days. First of all, a hope update. How do I say this? We pretty much sold out. I mean, there will be some tickets left at the door, but we don't know how many. It all depends on how things are working out. But it's not going to be a lot. I'll tell you that right now. I think there's maybe a couple left on the website, but we put some up for people that might have missed out when we actually had to close it down last week. And that went very fast, but I think there might just be one or two left. So this is really the last chance to get those. Hope.net, the conference is next week. This is our last show before the conference. In fact, we won't be back on until August. And I think we need the time off, right, because we're just going nuts. we're going to be talking about Hope and various other things that that we're planning for the Hackers on Planet Earth conference at the Hotel Pennsylvania. But first, more importantly, what is up with Pokemon Go? My God, we've been inundated with stories about this. You know, Kyle and I have been driving around, and we noticed this a couple of days ago. Just a town out on the island, Port Jefferson, people were just mobbing the place, and we knew something was up. I didn't know about this Pokemon thing. And everyone's staring at their phones. I just thought it was normal antisocial behavior that we're surrounded by. Everyone's looking at their phone, not talking to the people they're with. And why don't they ever hang out with the people that they are talking to on the phone? Apparently, they weren't talking to anybody on the phone. They were hunting Pokemon or whatever it is that you do.
It looked exaggerated. It was more staring at the phone than we're used to, which we are, as a society, I think, a bit more used to. But it was stark. It was very almost disturbing to see these people just sort of engrossed in whatever visual display is in their palm and not actually really doing anything in that space that you would consider normal, especially for the time. This is happening at all hours of the day and night, and we found out what it is.
Well, I think it's good that we saw something going on and we knew right away this isn't right. There's something wrong with this scene here. Too many people are in the streets at all hours and they're all looking at their phones. You know, we're used to this kind of behavior, but this is a bit much. And that was before I had any idea what they were actually doing. And it wasn't until, I think, yesterday that we confirmed that, yes, in fact, these people are engaged in, what do you call these kinds of games?
Augmented reality games.
Augmented reality
AR.
Games, yeah. Where you actually, in fact, there's an article in the new 2600 that just came out. It's called Gaming Ingress. And this was the first time I had ever even heard about something like this. That's how out of it I am, that there are games where you actually have to go places physically and, I guess, what, check in? Is that what you call it?
Well, it's augmented reality uses your phone's camera to look at the actual environment around you, but then insert digital things into that environment, insert virtual things into the real environment. So when you're in a certain place and your phone senses this through GPS, you can then hold up your phone and it will show you your surroundings, but it will also show you the imaginary digital thingy that's standing right there in the game.
Yeah, there's an overlay of like a story or characters and different goals within the context of the game's storyline, except you're sort of participating in that storyline through acting or being in a real space that has been associated with the game in making use of the map functionality and GPS and stuff.
And what this also means is that if you're making a game that uses this, you can place things in your game at certain spots in the real world.
Yes, and go ahead, Bernie.
I just want to say this reminds me a lot of a similar technology, but only halfway to where it is now, which is around 2000. Geocaching became popular, where people were using GPS receivers, GPS navigators, and the internet this is before smartphones, 2000, to tell people that they had hidden, little tchotchkes or whatever, near particular GPS coordinates, under a tree, behind a stream, that sort of thing.
It was more like
that was half virtual world and half real world, and now we're even closer to the virtual augmented reality.
Yeah, it's more of like a scavenger hunt or a treasure hunt, because you're actually getting a physical object or unearthing some kind of thing that you can take back, or a storage device, like a little box or treasure chest, as it were, to bring in a memento from this find that you made. Whereas this is those items and things are within the game itself, and has a lot of different ways you can. It ends up having unintended consequences, where certain things, it might be maybe it's just a flagpole or a monument, it might have a different value in the context of the game. It can be turned into something else. It might be some kind of facility in the game story.
Well, I'd just like to ask the other people here if you guys have actually noticed behavior from human beings in the street. Rob, have you?
I have, not in the street, but at my day job, everyone was talking about this when it came out, and somebody was showing me what it was during lunch, and in the process of this, found one of the imaginary creatures on the plate of the person eating food across from him, and was able to capture it.
Okay, well, I can tell you exactly what happened there. He had just gotten the game, right?
When
this happened. When you first get the game, they show up right in front of you. I know, because we were driving, and it was right on the dashboard in front of us. And instead of swerving all over the street like we were doing, all we had to do was throw a ball at the thing, and we didn't have to. Now, don't do that, folks. Now, I was a passenger, and I wasn't in any way causing problems for Kyle, who was driving. I just was very excited when I saw that this thing was right on the dashboard, and all you had to do is throw a ball at it, and then I think you get a free one when you start.
Another one reportedly in the real world was yesterday, I think, and the day before it was Manhattan Henge, where if you're in a certain part of New York City, the sun lines up perfectly with the streets.
The second leg of Manhattan Henge.
Yeah, the second leg of Manhattan Henge. And so this is normally something where people will gather in crowds and take pictures, stand out in the middle of the street when traffic lights allow, hopefully, and take pictures of what's going on. But now people were reporting at this that not everyone was standing up obliviously behind their phones. They were also looking down at their phones because they were doing this thing in the game.
Bernie, did you notice any behavior?
No, I haven't, but I've been wondering if these Pokemons, do they run out into the street and cause people
it's interesting you should say that, because that's one of the first things that I think any of us thought of, all these people running around with phones trying to hunt imaginary creatures. You have all kinds of situations.
This is actually one of the reasons this did not appear as a phenomena sooner. The parent company behind this game is very concerned about their brand and the image, and wanted safety to become a big part of their research and development, so that it was actually ready to be used in real world places where you have hazards like that. They didn't want kids going into the street, you know, playing this game and getting hurt as a result. It would reflect badly on their brand and on the game and the fun of it itself.
Well, you know, there are a bunch of things that are going on, though, because apparently what they call Pokestops are basically put in recognizable places, historical landmarks, things like that. It's causing problems because some historical landmarks aren't really into all these people running around with their phones hunting these creatures. Washington, D.C.'s Holocaust Museum springs to mind. They're not amused at all. They've asked Pokemon Go players to stay away. The museum has been designated a Pokestop where players can pick up items like Pokeballs and revives, of course. Their communications director was forced to point out that playing a game inside a memorial to victims of Nazism is extremely inappropriate. Yeah, I mean, but how do you stop it once it's actually there? Once you actually label something a Pokestop, it's kind of hard, I think, to unlabel it then.
Yeah, I also saw a friend of mine posted on Twitter a picture of a Pokemon that was in one of the reflecting pools at the World Trade Center Memorial. So,
wow. I mean, it seems to me, though, that this could be sort of fused with activism in an interesting way. if you could assign certain strategic spots where people need to get to. And there's really not much that the authorities can do about that, and especially if people are trying to get to places that they deem to be off limits. What I don't know, and maybe one of you guys understands how this works, and you know, I've been familiar with this, somewhat familiar with this, for exactly 20 hours, maybe. How do you label a location as something that people should go to? Do we have the ability to do that, or is that something that only the game manufacturer people can do?
Yeah, our curiosity is what level would it be that you then can make those designations, or is it even something that is corresponds with the level that you've reached?
Rob?
Yeah, for this particular game, it seems to be something that just the game company themselves has some kind of algorithm to assign these values to real world things. One of the requirements appears to be places of worship. Real world places of worship are important in the Pokemon game.
We had to go to the First Presbyterian Church at 2 a.m. yesterday, and believe me, they were not happy about that. But you had to hunt these things.
Yeah, and the funny thing about this too is whatever database the game operators are using might not always be up to date. There is a case of a person who lives in a house that used to at one point be a church, and now since his place is still marked as a church in whatever database that Nintendo uses, he's now got kids milling about on his lawn trying to catch Pokemon or recharge them or whatever you do, because the machine thinks he's a church.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's a bit disturbing, but it makes me think that you can't just label your enemy's house as a Pokestop. Although they have these things, believe it or not, called lure modules. Lure modules sounds really ominous, where you can lure, but apparently what you lure are Pokemon. Is that the right plural use? Pokemon?
Yeah, it's like sheep and sheep.
Yeah, so basically you're not luring other humans. You're just luring the characters that you then hunt. But it's possible you can lure humans too, and there's concern over predators and criminals and things like that. So I don't know, I've never seen a crowd of people so quickly influenced to do things, except on television. We were in a small village last night that was crowded with people hours after the village had closed. And the authorities really didn't seem to be that concerned. I mean, there was nothing to really be concerned about, but it was an awfully weird scene.
Well, one of the main things about the video gaming scene and in general is that it's fueled by speculation, possibilities, hidden things, Easter eggs, things that you can be the first one to find or the only one to find. And so in regards to the whole what can be done with this, I think if you started a rumor that something in the game was at a specific place, you could immediately have every player in the immediate area converge on it.
Yeah, I haven't communicated with any other people yet, but I know there's all kinds of things you can do, and it can take a lot of your time.
It's really odd to just see how people come together and are intrigued by it just from a puzzle-solving perspective, and I think it's along the lines of what Rob was saying, that there's this fascination. People not only started using it very, very quickly, but are also figuring it out very, very quickly. They may have been just introduced to it in the last week, and there are already so many people that have a pretty good understanding of what it's all about and how it works. But there's this sense of sharing, too. There's a lot of people going through the same sort of things, figuring it out. As you said, you already knew what this other person was doing. They had seen something in front of them, and that's a result of becoming a new player in the game. But it really was fascinating to see the intrigue at just figuring it out and looking at it from a puzzle-solving perspective.
Bernie, yes, last word on this.
You'd mentioned a couple of months ago a challenge for people who to get sued by Donald Trump to get a free ticket or something. And I'm wondering, this, I wouldn't advocate this or not, but I would be amused if some hacker were to hack into the servers of this Pokemon game company and have like a mobile Pokestop that would follow Donald Trump around with like hundreds of Pokemons and points and things you gather up. So then you'd have all these people, an even greater number, just pawing over Donald Trump, and the Secret Service would have to fend off real people while the virtual Pokemon would be scurrying about.
Well, this is definitely fodder for hackers to play with. And in fact, I'm certain this is going to be a thing at the Hope Conference. So if somebody can figure out a fun thing to do with Pokemon Go for Hope, we'd love to see what you are able to create and what imaginative uses we might be able to demonstrate to the world. But wow, that's I never expected to be talking about something like this. But it's weird. It's going on outside. It's something that you can't help but notice.
And everybody seems to know about it.
Yeah, they sure do. It's all over the media. Okay, so that's that. Write to us, oth@2600.com, if you have any comments on this or anything else. Moving on, going back to the Hope Conference, which will be taking place a week from this coming Friday. Wow, I can't believe it. But in 2 weeks, it'll be over. We can rest. But we've been featuring some of the talks that are coming up. We have, I believe, well over 100 talks, if you count all the tracks that we have and workshops. Just so many different things to present. But this is one that's near and dear to my heart. I know it is to yours as well, Bernie. This is a talk on tuning in to New York City's Pirates of the Air, pirate radio here in New York. And we have with us in the studio right now David Gorin, who will be giving that talk Friday, a week from Friday at the Hope Conference. David, welcome.
Hey, thanks. I'm happy to be here. Thanks
yeah.
for having
so
me.
Now, how did you get interested in pirate radio, listening to pirate radio?
Well, I'm a longtime shortwave radio listener, and starting sort of seriously back in the late 70s, early 80s, and that's really, in my experience, where you could hear pirates. Mm-hmm. Occasionally on AM, but I started coming up to New York City in the mid-80s and heard actual FM pirates. So it was sort of like a hobby broadcasting scene. There was WHOT, WFUN, playing oldies. They were on discreetly, usually on 91.5 or 91.9.
91.9, that's always where I'd find them.
Yeah, well, also 91.5 WNYE, they used to sign off at midnight.
Oh, okay. So then the pirates just would sign back on.
Yeah. And they were always on very discreetly on the weekends. I heard they had some coordination between them.
Uh-huh.
And this went on. And then starting around 94, 95, there was a station, WBAD, which is sort of a precursor of what we have now. They started playing hip-hop all the time on 91.9. Again, mostly in the evenings, but they were on in hours that the previous pirates weren't. And then starting in late 96, I started to hear on 87.9, a Haitian broadcaster, 88.1, Radio Moshiach from the Lubavitcher Hasidic community were on the air. And slowly it grew, and it's been going on almost 20 years. There are Caribbean stations, Orthodox Jewish stations, Spanish stations, religious stations within the Caribbean community. And now on a typical evening or weekend, which is the peak hours, I live in Flatbush, Brooklyn, I can hear about 35 stations.
Now, most of the frequencies you mentioned are below 92, but I understand that the pirates are everywhere.
They're all the way up the dial. They go up to 107.9, which is the Flava station. They're just everywhere. Sometimes some of them seem savvy and some of them seem like they don't have a clue. They'll be right next to WMYC.
They're right next to us, too, 99.3. I caught a pirate.
There's 99.3. That's Star FM.
Yeah, we've heard.
You know who they are.
Quite a few. Yeah, that's exactly it.
Could you pass a message to them? Please move to a different frequency because it's too close to us. And, we're a little nervous about that. But you mentioned 87.7, I believe.
87.9. 87.7, it's interesting, but it's not a pirate. Yes. That's a Franken FM.
Yeah, that used to be on Channel 6, right?
Right. It's still on. It's Channel 6 audio. And I think Bernie may know more about this, but I think for a while they had to have something visual, but yes. I'm not sure they have to anymore.
Well, since they've gone digital, is Channel 6 even at that frequency anymore? Bernie, do you know?
Channel 6 still does the FCC does still allow analog TV broadcasting on Channel 6. The original plan of the FCC years ago was to have all the VHF TV6 frequencies moved up to higher frequencies in a digital mode, and there was only like a handful of them across the country, including WPVI here in Philadelphia, that said, no, we want to stay on Channel 6 because our signal will go farther on this lower frequency. As it turned out, it didn't. It really screwed themselves, and they had to ask for higher and higher levels once it went digital. But what the FCC's plan was to expand the FM broadcast band downwards to like 76 megahertz, which would have been awesome.
Yeah.
It would have freed up all this extra spectrum. It would have gone, instead of from 88 to 108, it would have gone from 76 to 108. But because of a few TV station holdouts that just were like dogs in the manger kind of a situation, they wanted to stay there, and it was to their own detriment. It's really a shame it worked out this way, and this is one of the reasons why we have pirate radio, because there aren't enough frequency slots available to serve a community.
That's exactly right, and it's been growing over the years, and it seems so chaotic that I could not really make any sense of who the stations were. Whenever you see online people talking about the pirate scene, you just see a big string of numbers. So about 2 years ago, I decided to apply some of my shortwave research skills, and I'm a radio producer, and I've done a lot of pieces on radio and community and number stations and all sorts of things. So I made a big chart, which documents everything I've heard in those 2 years, as well as some historical things. And so at the Hope Conference, I'll be presenting my research in the chart, and I'll be playing a lot of samples. And I've been talking to station managers and pirate listeners, and I'm on the trail of a few pirate operators, but they're hard to get a hold of.
Well, now, on the subject of samples, you've brought some with you today, and we have one queued up. Do you want to intro this and tell us what we're going to hear?
Yeah, this is... this is 92.1. I probably recorded this in 2014. Grace Deliverance, they're called GD Radio, not for the Grateful Dead, but for the Grace Deliverance Chapel in Brooklyn. Not sure they're on this frequency. Someone else is on now. But this is a really interesting minute-long excerpt of a DJ. He's been greeting his audience. He's probably somewhere in Flatbush, Crown Heights. He's of Caribbean heritage, but he's saying hello to his Spanish listeners. And in this segment, he shouts out to his Yiddish fans in Crown Heights.
Okay, here we go. Everybody should praise the Lord.
Our Lord is great and greatly to be praised. In the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness. Beautiful for situation is the joy of the whole world. The joy of the whole world is Mount Zion on the side of the north, the city of the great King. Oh yeah! Praise him! From the rising of the sun unto the going down of the same, the name of the Lord is to be praised. To all my Jewish people up there in Crown Heights, Vush Maxter. Oh God, everything is good. Oh yeah, Bulk Bishop. Thank God. Good afternoon.
Wow. Okay. You know, I want to keep listening to that station. I really do.
That's a really infectious track. I have a 5-minute chunk, but I just thought I'd winnow it down to about
a minute. That was recorded in Brooklyn.
I was recorded in Brooklyn. I have a listening post in my house in Flatbush, so I'm really kind of right in ground zero. I can hear stations from New Jersey and the Bronx, but really the main beat of what I hear is in Flatbush. Mostly Caribbean.
And what kind of range can a station like that get?
Probably 3 to 5 miles plus.
That's a lot in a packed city like this.
It's amazing. There are as many pirates as there are licensed stations. And the farthest that I've heard is either 98.9 in the Bronx or on 91.7, which is home to sort of a round robin, and I have some more samples from that frequency. Sometimes during the day when most of the pirates are off, but it sort of gives you an example, a moment to hear places beyond the local, because the local stations are up. So in Essex County, about 28 miles away, there's a station called GEMS, G-E-M-S, GEMS.com. And on Facebook, their DJs go live, and you can watch them. And GEMS is actually interesting as an aside. It's almost more like a college radio station. It's much more kind of has a more relaxed vibe. But it's definitely unlicensed.
You know, it's amazing because, Bernie, I don't know if you remember a couple of years ago, we were trying to track down a pirate station in Queens that was stepping on my other radio station's frequency of 90.1, which doesn't really reach Queens, but sometimes it can. And it's nice if it's able to without another station interfering. It was a Spanish station that we found, and we tracked it down, I believe, to a church in Corona.
That's right, Corona, Queens. We drove around with some special equipment. And we drove around, and I was in the back seat. I was a back seat driver telling you where to drive, and I had this radio equipment in the back of the car. And I was like, here it is. And we looked up, there's the antenna. And so Mike and I, we went up the steps and knocked on some doors. I had my 2600 hoodie on, which Mike was afraid that somebody would think was like, looked like some Federales uniform or something. But they were having a live service downstairs. It was being broadcast on the air. But I talked to one of the people that met you at the door, and I said, I need to speak to the pastor. And he said, he's busy right now, but here's his number. So I called him like a couple of days later, and we had a good conversation. I just explained to him that he was interfering with WUSB, and would he mind moving? Because interference is one of the things that attracts the FCC when there's interference to licensed stations. And he was very nice, and he just moved frequencies. It was wonderful that everybody was happy.
Of course, somebody else took the frequency right after they moved, but you can't just leave an empty frequency around, apparently. But it was what I was amazed by when we did that was seeing how low the transmitter actually was. I think it was only on the second floor, maybe on the roof of a two-story building.
It was a Comet 95SL 5/8 wave ground plane antenna for anybody.
How in God's name do you know what kind of antenna it was just by looking at it?
Because it is the most popular pirate FM. It's a commercial grade antenna that it's really hobbyist grade, but it's commercially sold. But it's perfect for FM. It's what we used at Radio Mutiny in West Philly back in the 90s. It is a very good antenna, and I was talking to David about this, or maybe it was Matt Blaze. He and I met up with David a while back on this project, and we speculated that most of these pirates were probably using a Comet 95SL antenna.
Yeah. And with that height of just two stories off the ground, I was able to receive that that station from Corona in Manhattan. It was able to get that far.
Wow!
Yeah, they really go far. And when I walk around Flatbush, I've spotted a few, like just on the second floor. And actually, there's just been a report issued by the New York State Radio Broadcasters Association, who are wanting to tamp down the pirates or take them off the air, and they. For the fourth year in a row, have done a survey in like four different locations in the Bronx, in Paterson, New Jersey, in Newark, and in Brooklyn. And it's funny. Someone was just telling me about this the other day, and lo and behold, this was released. I think for the first time. I think the previous three weren't. If you look at Radio Inc., the magazine, they have a link to the 100-page PDF, and they have shots of antennas that they discovered. On basically a DF pirate.
Emmanuel, wow. I just want to mention to our listeners, if anybody emails us at oth@2600.com, I can send them a link to this New York State Broadcasters report. It's like a 100-page PDF, as David said. It's full of great pictures of these pirate radio antennas. One of them, the one in East Orange, New Jersey, is right next door to the East Orange police station.
Wow.
There's some really great pictures. And there's some really good comments, too, from the engineer who crafted the study. Some of them are kind of bogus, like the RF energy poses a public threat. And I mean, that's nonsense.
Well, there's a slant.
It's interesting.
It's written with a slant, sort of protecting the interests of broadcasters. So, it's, you know, there are some things that no doubt have relevance and other things that they're just kind of trying to make the case. But what they've discovered is that they're increasing and that the FCC really hasn't done or can't do much to keep them up the air.
Yeah, and by making it an issue and entangling more and more operators as sort of like casting a wide net, then they can say, see, look what we're doing. We're policing this a little bit better, and look what we found. And yeah,
I just don't think it's going to have much impact on the FTC because they don't have the funds. They don't have, and I think they've given up. I think short of a quasi-military effort, there's no way to take 38 stations off the air. This survey estimated that they heard 75 from these four locations, and they said there are probably 100, and I think there are probably more.
You know, without giving specifics, I've known of stations that have operated in the commercial band 24/7 for years without being harassed, and I think that just speaks to the lack of interference that these stations actually are presenting to commercial broadcasters, because if they were actually interfering, then people would complain. But without complaints, the FCC won't do anything.
Well, I hear it both ways. I talked to Ken Friedman, a station manager of WFMU. Mm-hmm. He says he's made complaints, and they've never been acted on by the FCC because their staff is so small. And
Well, you have another clip following this, the one we just played. So you want to tell us something about this?
Yeah, well, the first one was a ska gospel in which they were talking, at least theoretically, to the Orthodox community in Crown Heights. Here's a station that I heard a few months ago, and it was a 91.9, which is usually empty during the day, and I was hearing a rebroadcast of WCBS for weeks. I couldn't figure out who this was. When they weren't on the air, they had the carrier on with the wine, and finally it gave way to this station.
נצח ישראל לעולם לא ישקר בנים ישובו לגבולם רווח יעמוד ממקום אחר אלוקנו צור מגינם נצח ישראל לעולם לא ישקר בנים ישובו לגבולם רווח יעמוד ממקום אחר אלוקנו צור מגינם
גם בחסד הארץ היא שלנו דם שנשבח כמיים בשנים שכבר נרדפנו לא נאבד את האשתונות להתאמץ ולא ניסוג כי אבינו עוד איתנו ואין לנו מה לדאוג גם בזמנים קשים אותנו לא נטש לא
וואו So what do we have, Hebrew rap?
It's a Hebrew dancehall reggae, essentially.
That's, I would subscribe to a package of pirate stations. If some enterprising provider out there wants to provide, like, you know, the pirate FM 100, top 100, I would subscribe to that just to hear the variety of music that
It was fascinating. And they came on the air. They were on the air for a few weeks, and they've been gone ever since. They finally had some Hebrew sermons, and they played, I have a version of Let It Be in Hebrew. I mean, it's just a very interesting mix geared to the Orthodox Jewish community.
The thing is, if you listen to regular FM radio stations, you don't hear that kind of diversity. You just hear the same things. And people want diversity, so that's why there's a need for pirate stations.
Oh, I remembered my thought from earlier when my mind sort of went blank. It's not that they're not interfering, but some of the pirates, I think, have some strategy that a lot of the main frequencies are on rimshot stations. So they don't jump on top of WMYC, but they'll be on WALK's frequency, which is in Long Island. So probably they're not getting a lot of complaints. And so a lot of them, I think, sort of hide on those regional frequencies on the Jersey Shore, on Long Island. And,
it depends where they actually are, because if they did that on Long Island, where WALK is a very powerful station, they probably would get complaints. But if they're doing that in Queens, no one's going to really notice.
Yeah, but I know when I contacted Steve Schultes, the chief technology officer at WMYC, he was like, yes, I want to talk to you about this. Because they have had a problem, and their listeners do complain. But again, I think it comes down to enforcement doesn't have the resources. And if you check this great site by John Anderson's DIYmedia.net, he has a letter that Tom Wheeler, the FCC commissioner, wrote last year. And it's sort of like it was in response to all the reps, you know, political reps in New York writing a letter to the FCC, and he was like, not much we can do.
It's like, in light of that level of enforcement, it's really a tough sell as far as dissuading people, given the amount of power and the impact that it has on the communities that are listening.
And it's reasonably inexpensive. You know, and if they get busted, they often get back on the air. Another Jewish station, and there are many more than just Jews, there are more Caribbean stations, but there are about four or five Orthodox Jewish stations where I am. And they were on WALK's frequency, and they were busted about 2 years ago. And
that's
now they're
97.5.
Yeah, now they're on 95.1, and sometimes they still air their old IDs from 97.5. And when they were busted, here's something I've observed, that the communities that these stations are targeted to, the community, and why should they? They don't really know that they're illegal stations. They just think that this is our station. Yep. So there was a whole hue and cry. Why is J-Root Radio off 97.5?
That, that like sense of ownership that comes with that impact, yeah. Like the thing that it, the fact that it does
serve.
Well,
I mean, I've seen they have websites sometimes. Some of them even sell advertising. Yeah, I don't know how they do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, you're showing me all the websites.
Ads for different restaurants or the things like that. We've heard a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, a lot of ad blocks. At my talk, I'm going to have this big chart I've compiled, and probably 3/4 of the station have or had websites.
But what you say about the cost factor really resonates, because even when you're dealing with completely legal entities, I know this from experience with the other radio station I work with, WUSB, we have a perfectly legal signal that is supposed to reach a particular area. But yet there's a 100-watt station in Connecticut that completely obliterates the signal on the North Shore of Long Island. And that's a legal station too, but it's not supposed to be going that far. But without a lot of money to pursue it, there's nothing you can do. And we've been told that so many times, powerless. And it's true both in the pirate world and outside the pirate world.
Right. I think I have a sample that can speak to this. I was talking about 91.7 earlier, and late in the afternoon, you can hear a station from West Orange, New Jersey, called La Main Street. They sign on about 3 or 4. It's an Andean station for the Ecuadorian community, Andean music.
Wow.
And this, I think, also underscores why the pirates are on the air, because I've never heard that on any of the brokered stations that you can buy time. Mm-hmm. So this is an example of La Main Street. They're on the air, and then a local Caribbean station comes on. It's on number 7.
You know, it'd be great just to have a guide that people can easily reference, but if you publish a guide like that, then it's also easier to crack down on them.
Well, you know, they're on the air. They're giving out their numbers and their websites. I don't want to crack down, but I think this is a really interesting cultural phenomenon, and I am working on funding an online map, which you can not see where they're located, because I don't know, but you can see the coverage areas, you can click, you can hear links and interviews, you can hear people on both sides of the unlicensed-licensed divide. But, right, it is kind of touchy.
Bernie, did you have something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you were talking about the how inexpensive, the cost of entry has plummeted to set up an illegal FM broadcast station now, that you could go on eBay and just search for FM broadcast transmitter. You can find tons of them for like $50 for like a 10-15 watt station, which will broadcast for several miles. And that Comet 95 SL antenna is like about less than $100. So basically for under $200, for about $200-some, if you already have studio gear, you have the transmitter and the feed line and the antenna. This is chump change, and people are doing it now because it's so inexpensive. And I don't see how the FCC can possibly stop it.
All right, we're starting to sound like Shop at Home for pirate radio here. If you do this, please don't broadcast on 99.5. Well, actually, what happens if they do broadcast on a commercial, right smack on top of a commercial station? How much interference can they actually cause?
A lot. I mean, WMYC, there was a station on 94.1 right next to it, and there's a great Twitter list called BK Pirate Watch, and the actress Martha Plimpton found them and said, I'm trying to listen to WMYC, you know, to All Things Considered, but I'm hearing, you know, reggae music. And so she was informed that that 94.1 was a pirate and was interfering. Now, 94.1 has been gone for a while.
Well, did she stick with the reggae, or did she go back to All Things Considered?
I'm not sure. I might try to follow up with her on that. And I know, and having spoken with Ken Friedman a few days ago, they're constantly plagued by a station on 90.9, Radio Independence.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is a Haitian station. And to the degree, actually, I think there was another Road March, another station in Newark, was interfering with FMU's second station in Hudson County,
okay,
New York.
WMFU, I believe.
Yeah. So even though they were in Newark, and on 90.1, not 91.1, they were cutting into the edge of their frequency, of their
wow
coverage. Yeah. So, you
know, it does affect, you know, the smaller stations and the non-commercial stations more than it does the commercial ones. So right. I would advise if pirate radio people listen to me at all, that you take commercial frequencies, frequencies above 92. And, of course, we're above 92 as well. We're the exception. But, you know, a lot of stations there, they're a lot more powerful. And right. And actually, there's a lot more space between them.
There are a lot in the non-commercial band. Between 87.9 and 91.9, they're probably eight, mm-hmm. you know, where I am. And again, talking to Ken Friedman, and I'll excerpt some from his interview in my talk, he was, you know, like, they're operating as commercial stations on non-commercial band, and so that irritated him, you know, in addition to all the other problems
right, right.
that he's suffering. So you could play now. This is La Main Street in 91.7, and they're on the air until suddenly a Flatbush station comes on.
So this is the Ecuadorian.
This is the Ecuadorian.
From Jersey.
Yeah.
Okay, and we're going to hear another station come on?
Sign on right on top of it, another pirate station.
At the same time, or do they wait for them to sign off?
Nope.
Oh, so there's just
and this happens. Anarchy. This happens a lot.
All right, let's take a listen to this.
La canción de la vaca loca, dice saludos para la familia Meléndez. Y por favor, esa canción, póngale. Saludos, gracias por alegrarnos nuestros corazones. Qué lindo saber que la gente está enganchado de la promoción. Vamos, amigos, súbele. Y tú, a moverte, muévete eso, muévete.
Arriba, llegó el jueves.
¿Qué jueves, maestro? ¿Cuál jueves? Estamos en Mases. No, pero... Pero huele, no, como que huele ya jueves, no, con esa alegría que pone el DJ Carlitos.
Wow, so they completely obliterated them, didn't they?
Yes, and so the West Orange station was, I don't know, probably about 16 miles from me, but uh-huh. this was a station within a mile or 2 mile radius.
It's exciting. It reminds me, you were mentioning shortwave, of listening, you know, hearing a station going off the air, then another signal, you hear the interval signals and different language perhaps. You know, shortwave, it's not that exciting anymore, is it?
It's really not, and this is, it's kind of interesting, and I don't know really many, you know, radio hobbyists who like love to take lists of stations. Looking at these scenes, I sort of made an effort in that direction to try to codify what's out there. And that happens a lot. I mean, there are some stations that have really good tech and a really good sound, but even the best sounding station, you could tell they don't have Orban processing. They don't have that like extra slick part. But a lot of them, even though they're interesting and they're serving an underserved community, they have very poor tech. There are stations that skip for hours. I can play one at some point.
Skip? What, a CD skipping? Or
yeah, you want to go to number 9?
Number 9, sure. I got to hear this. So which station is this?
This is Radio Liberté. It's a Haitian station on 89.7. It's crammed right between 89.5, WSOU, a college station, and WKCR, 89.9. And it's interfering with their HD carriers as well as the main station.
Okay, and we're going to hear a skip. All right. Well, you know, it's a mix between Laurie Anderson and Panda Bear, I think. I would listen to that. In fact, you know, I hate to say it, but we've skipped records longer than that. We really have.
Well, when I found this, it went on for about 20 minutes uh-huh. before it returned to the regular programming. But in the early years when I wasn't paying super close attention, I had a small child, and I, you know, But often you would hear this. It was not uncommon to hear Skipping Station.
Uh-huh. And it wasn't uncommon in the past either. If you listen to radio in the 70s and 80s, you heard mistakes. You heard sloppiness. And today there's too much emphasis on being polished and sounding like everybody else. So it's good to hear the human aspect of it.
Well, that is really there. And if you want to hear another cut, this is the same station. It's a different station, but another Haitian station called La Voix du Peuple. This was the Caribbean station that jumped on the Ecuadorian station.
Is this number 10?
This is number 8. It's sort of a sign-on. It's very reminiscent of shortwave radio, okay. Interval signal sign-on.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I love interval signals. Okay, so this is a Haitian station, you say?
Yes, and this went on for about 20 minutes. This is just 5 seconds of it.
Okay.
Vous écoutez la voix du peuple. 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 Vous écoutez la voix du peuple.
Il n'y a pas de débat, tout le monde n'a jamais eu refus. Refus, pour qui ça? Problème income tax. Jamais de débat, jamais attendre tout le monde. Qui a été fait le income tax là? Dans de l'albali, en bombe.
Wow, that's great. I never heard an interval signal that had a voice like that. So that's.
Yeah, it doesn't sound digitized. And then I guess they just looped it. They don't usually sign on this way. I've never heard it on that station's uh-huh. frequency again. And now the station, La Voix du Peuple, they may be under another name because I've heard other IDs. But it's often, I think it's possible that some of these stations are brokering time to people who run streams. It's just, it's hard to know. I'm trying to learn more about the model.
I'm just blown away by your collection that you've got. And these are real, like these happenings are just sort of mayflies. You know, they would happen and never be heard from again if they were heard at all in the first place. And here you are collecting them. I know archivists like our friend Jason Scott would go nuts over this kind of thing, because this is something that is going on just subtly behind the scenes for most people. And what led you to start recording this and gathering your data?
Well, I do audio archiving in the shortwave realm. I've done pieces, you know, using things from different archives, sometimes my own, sometimes other. I have a piece I did for NPR a long time ago on the number stations, the espionage-related stations, and similar projects. So I just decided when I had a little extra time that I was going to try to record this scene. When I first heard it seemed very monolithic to me. It was a lot of soca. You know, a lot of reggae, but the more I listen, you start to hear anomalies. I don't know if you have time for any more samples, but
sure. I could do this all night. This is awesome.
On 91.7, which usually has La Voix du Peuple, the Haitian station locally, and that Ecuadorian station, La Main Street. One day I tuned in and I heard number 6, which I call Mystery Station. And I heard it one time.
Okay, so this is from where again?
This is, it's on 91.7. I think it's somewhere in Flatbush, Midwood, Brooklyn. I heard it once. I never heard it again. It seems to be an Uzbeki or Turkish broadcast.
Fascinating. Yeah. Okay, let's take a listen to this.
Arabeskin en iyisi. Türkiye'nin en damar radyosu. Tutku FM. Bu frekansı çok seveceksiniz. Burası Tutku FM.
So I had a question. Have you noticed any subterfuge or ways they try to mask where they are? In other words, Like you mentioned brokering a little bit. Do the stations ever say they're one thing and then they're really in another place? They try to maybe make it sound like they're much further away or in another part of the country.
It's a good tactic if they're not doing that.
I haven't noticed that, but what you do hear a lot is feeds from stations in the Caribbean. Sometimes they'll name check other cities.
Okay.
This kind of scene is also very big in Boston and Miami.
Okay.
In the same way. But I don't know that. I think it's already so murky and chaotic that they don't really need to do that. But I think they're always sort of moving their locations around physically.
David, let me ask you this. Is this something that's particularly unique to New York, or does this happen all over the country?
It seems to be big in New York, Boston, and Miami. Miami has a lot of Haitian stations in particular. I was in Boston in the fall, and a casual tune, I counted about 15 on an evening.
Now, what is it about Haitian stations that make them so prevalent?
That's an interesting question. I think radio is very prime in a lot of Caribbean cultures, and so it's sort of very important to be on the air. The literacy rate is somewhat low in Haiti, so hearing news on the radio is very ingrained in the culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's part of it.
Interesting. Wow. Bernie, any final questions from you?
Yeah, this is going to be an amazing talk at the 11th Hope, July 22nd. This July 22nd, right? This Friday.
Yeah, this talk is scheduled for 7 p.m. in the Friedman Room. It's called Tuning Into New York City's Pirates of the Air. And David will be playing some excerpts and talking about all this. It's really fascinating.
And I wanted to also mention David has an amazing website called shortwaveology.net. He's too modest to plug his own website on the air here, but I highly recommend shortwaveology.net. And I met David years ago, even though we lived in the same place at one time. I met him at the annual SWL Fest. If you check out swlfest.com, it's where I've met a lot of amazing radio people. It's outside of Philadelphia. I met David. I met Mark Fahey, who gave the talk about North Korea at the most recent Hope conference, and we're doing an amazing talk about monitoring radio and television from around the world this year. A lot of great content worth coming to Hope for, so don't miss it.
Can we go out with one more? Just give me a number and we'll...
So first I'll just say thanks to Ed for the promotion that shortwaveology.net has a lot of shortwave-related material. I have a soundcloud.com/shortwaveology site that has July 4th band scan that I did, 2.5-hour band scan of the Pirates, and a lot of things that people can dive into. Let's go out on... some of these stations have really great IDs. Go to number 5. This is the station 999.
Locking down the street.
99.9, it is the yo, number one in the line, Fair Lion Sisu.
Triple 9 HD in the mix.
99.9.
Okay, this is not 99.9, it's 99.5. David Gurren, thank you so much for sharing this with us.
It's great being here. Thanks for having me.
And we will see you at Hope, and we'll see hopefully a lot of our listeners at Hope. We'll be back in, I think, 3 weeks. Write to us, oth@2600.com, and stay tuned for the Personal Computer Show. Good night. We'll be right back.
Wow, I love the music on the Personal Computer Show. Hey, condolences go out to all of the police officers that were shot. Also, all the families of the black men that were killed, including the man who had the gun in the Walmart, and the police stormed in and shot him down. Tamar Rice shot in less than 2 seconds or 2 seconds. And Eric Gardner for standing around doing nothing and got killed. And there's plenty of it been going on for hundreds of years, but now it's on video. Hey, but now it's 8 o'clock. And that means it's time for the Personal Computer Show. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Also streamed on the web at wbai.org. And today is the July 13th. Lucky 13. So that means we have a great show today. What do you think about that?
Hello, world. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key in the studio of WBAI in Brooklyn with our engineer, Stevie DB. Unfortunately, we still don't have the facilities for listener call-ins this evening, but via Skype, joining us this evening is Joe King on remote. Joe, are you there?
I am, Hank. And
I think you have to adjust the volume.
Hold it,
Joe. We're going to have to do some volume checking first.
Oh, yeah, I got him up.
Can you speak a little louder, Joe?
I can, but okay. I'm getting very bad feedback. As a matter of fact, it sounds like a 7-second delay, Stevie.
I think Stevie, have you on delay? I think you have to take it off, Stevie.
No, I don't have Joe on delay.
Okay. Well, hey, listen, last week we promised a listener something because, Joe, you said that you had a 1 terabyte USB flash drive for $9. I really was scratching my head, and I questioned it, and I asked, can you verify that? And now, I know that Stevie has asthma, but I guess we'll just have to have a make-believe drum roll. So with a drum roll, tell me more about this 1 terabyte, $9 USB flash drive, Joe.
Well, not only is it, hold on, I'm going to have to do something about that. Repeat, I'm hearing.
Joe, we can barely make out what you're saying.
No, when he steps away from the phone, we can't hear him.
Oh, well, you know.
Try to stay by the phone somehow when you speak, Joe.
Is he there? If he's not,
right,
he's around.
Oh, you sound much better now, Joe. So tell me about your fabulous $9 purchase.
We can hear you fine when you on the phone.
Nope, he's breaking up.
No, you're breaking up.
You're
what
breaking
did you do?
Up. You're motorboating, Joe.
And
well, I'll tell you what. We're going to hold off on this. And Stevie, see if you can get him on that other alternate line. Okay?
I'm going to try the other line, Joe.
Yeah, he's going to try the other line, and I'm going to make a couple announcements, okay, in the meantime, Joe.
Okay.
Just to remind everyone, we have some housekeeping to do. Windows 10 free upgrade ends July the 29th. So if you want to... if you want to do an upgrade from Windows 7, 8, or 8.1 to Windows 10, home to home, or pro to pro, you got to do it before then. But let me tell you, a listener had sent me a question. What if I want the upgrade and I want to go back to 7 because that's what I want to use, but I want to be able to save that upgrade so at least I have it when I want to use it? And here was my response. You go ahead with the upgrade, and after you've upgraded to Windows 10, what you do is you do an image save onto an external drive. Stevie, I hear phone ringing. And after you've done the image save to external drive, and that image save would include the whole operating system, Windows 10 and whatever you have on it, and you put it away, and then you go back to a restore point prior to the upgrade to Windows 10 itself, because there is a folder there called windows.old. That folder is the previous operating system intact. And what it would do is it would then restore that operating system the way you had it, and stored on the external drive would be your Windows 10 operating system. If you want to do it a little later and you don't want to immediately do it, you have to do it within 30 days because Microsoft will automatically delete that part, that subdirectory called Windows.old. So just remind everyone, yes, you can upgrade, keep a copy of Windows 10, and then go back to your previous operating system, but you got to follow those steps.
Hank, I've got a question for you.
Yes.
What is the rationale for automatically deleting that backup system?
So that's Microsoft's way of saying you are now officially permanently on 10. Oh, the silence is deafening. Okay.
I got to tell you, that's not an acceptable answer to my question.
Well, it may not be acceptable to you, but that is the answer. Okay.
No, I understand that is the answer, but it is not acceptable.
Well, you know what? Microsoft is a greater power than me, and if you don't like it, you can complain to Microsoft.
I'd have to complain to the federal government because it is against the law for somebody to fiddle-faddle with my computer.
Well, no, wait, Joe.
That's
Joe,
against that.
No, wait a minute, Joe. They also said if you don't want to do an upgrade, you can stay on your 7, 8, or 8.1, or even XP. But if you want to go to Windows 10, you'll have to pay for it in the future. After July the 29th or July 28th, you have to pay for it. And that's
and
what
then they won't. Then they won't automatically erase my 7 if I decide to go back?
No, the thing is, if you... what I'm saying is that if you did not do the upgrade, then there is no Windows.old.
Oh. If I pay for Windows 10, will I still have the ability to roll it back to Windows 7?
It's really up to Microsoft because there would be a date of creation on that subdirectory folder. And they may just look at it and say, okay, that was created after July 29th. We won't touch it. But if it was created...
But you don't know that for sure. You're saying that's
illogical. The answer is we don't know, and I'm going to be truthful with you. I don't think Microsoft knows at this point.
They know.
No. The reason why I say that is because Microsoft has a push to move everyone to Windows 10 as quickly as possible. And right now, 45% of the installed base of operating system is still Windows 7. So, it's like, hey, if you don't do it, you know, you're going to be punished. And then, of course, you know, the kid would nod his head, yes, Mom. And then the next day he does the same thing again. Who knows, okay? Hey, Joe, we've been waiting breathlessly about your test on this 1 terabyte USB flash that you got for $9.
Right.
Okay, I'll tell you about that in just a second. But first I want to tell you that by doing that test, I also got to test the restore or repair of Windows 7 after a major crash. And I'll tell you about that later, but I'm very pleased with Microsoft for a change. Now, let me tell you about what I bought from wish.com/geek. That's Wish, wish.com/geek. For about $9, plus I think it was $2 shipping, it might have been $3 shipping, I bought a miniature USB drive. I say miniature, one of the major companies had one that size, they called it the Atom. It's about the size of your thumbnail, just the nail part. When you put it into the slot, the USB slot, only about a quarter of an inch sticks out,
So technically, it's still a USB flash drive. It's technically a USB flash drive.
What's that? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
It is technically still a USB flash drive.
Yes, it is. It's still a USB flash drive, but if you stick it into your tablet or into your slot on your laptop or your desktop, it only extends, as I said, about a quarter or three-eighths of an inch. So that made it great, and that gives me extends a full terabyte of storage, which, as you know, is a fairly good amount if you're into photography or what have
especially
you.
Especially for $9.
There's one problem, though. Hank told me that it could just be the header, and it had one file on it, and I put a second file on it, and that was good. But Hank said it might not have the full terabyte, and he told me the best way to test it was to format it, because a formatting of it would give me a full reading of the drive and not just the header. When you pull a directory, it's just the header. I pulled the directory and found it had 983 point something or other gigabytes, which is, you know, just shy of a terabyte, and that was acceptable. So what I did was I tried to format it, and the format blew. That is, it did not finish successfully, and once that happened, the machine could not read the drive at all. Again, I spoke to Hank, and I found out about a piece of software called MiniTool Partition Wizard, which seemed very thorough. I examined it. I read the literature on it. If that could not format the drive either, and that was a very low-level thing. It was supposed to set up partitions and format the partitions. At that point in time, I had a blackout. Fuse blew. I should say a circuit breaker blew, because I don't have fuses. I replaced the item that was causing the short circuit. It had nothing to do with the computer. Put the circuit breaker back on and found I could not boot up my system. Called Hank and said, I haven't gotten into safe mode in so many years, I forgot. I've looked at the CMOS, I've looked at everything else on this drive, but I haven't found the safe mode. So he told me F8, which got me into safe mode, and the machine could not boot up in safe mode. It was really blown, I thought, and I was planning on having to pull the hard drive, put in a new one, establish a new operating system. I tried two more times to boot up the desktop, and I finally got into a thing called Restore, which is a Microsoft Windows method of repairing. And I tried running it, and it gave me a number of choices. One of the choices was to drop back to an